from 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Municipal leaders from across the country are in Pittsburgh this week discussing everything from the city of the future to everyday needs, transportation, public safety, and dealing with the federal government.
So starting to look at ways that we can work with the federal government to be good partners in the rollout of those technologies, allowing cities to continue to be the leaders there.
Also on today's show, researchers unveil new data on the impact of shale drilling on public health, and street mapping cars find methane leaks under the city's streets.
In total, most people don't know this, but of the global warming we're experiencing today, methane causes a quarter of that.
We'll discuss all of that, and U.S. Attorney David Hickton resigns from his dream job. That's ahead on our weekly news roundup. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. But first, this update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA, our weekly news roundup. I'm Kevin Gavin. Municipal leaders from across the country gathered in Pittsburgh to discuss the city of the future and how to meet the needs of their residents. The U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania steps down. Will that change the focus on which crimes federal authorities will focus? And we'll discuss that later in the program. But first, from detecting methane leaks under the streets of Pittsburgh to an annual look at the impact of drilling in the shale formation to concentration of diesel emissions downtown, it's been a week filled with news about our local environment and public health. Joining us in studio to talk about these, Bill O'Driscoll, reporter for Pittsburgh City Paper. Welcome, Bill. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
And Reed Frazier is a reporter for the Allegheny Front, a weekly program that airs on WESA and several stations in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and elsewhere. Welcome back to the show, Reed.
Hi, Kevin.
So let's start with the cool intersection of technology and environmental challenges, the methane mapping. So Pittsburgh, one of several cities involved in this pilot project involving the Environmental Defense Fund and Google Outreach, Google cars that map the streets and all that to help us with our directions. They had some special sensors attached to detect the methane leaks. So how did Pittsburgh come into play with this, Bill?
Apparently it was Peoples Gas, your gas utility, that reached out to Environmental Defense Fund, who are a national environmental group, and they were already working on this project with Google Outreach to detect methane in these different cities. Peoples Gas is in the midst of a giant rebuild of its pipeline network, which is old and leaky, and they wanted to see if they could do it better.
Yeah, and I understand that, nearly half of their pipes are like 50 years or older, and according to the EDF, the Environmental Defense Fund, they were saying like a quarter or more of them were sort of made of leaky or material, shall we say.
Stuff they would have used in the old days, like cast iron or uncoated steel, yes.
And this is something that EDF has been doing in other cities. A few years ago, they did a survey of Boston, which is like Pittsburgh, an older eastern city with ancient pipes. And they found 3% of the total gas in that was supposed to go to people's homes was leaking out of the system. I haven't seen any of the equivalent statistics in Pittsburgh, but you'd imagine, you know, with a system that old and that leaky, that there's got to be some efficiencies that Peoples could get out of this exercise.
So we've got a couple of issues here with the leaks. We've got the potential health impact on people, the environmental impact, and we even have, as you said, 3% not getting where it's supposed to. We have the waste of natural resources.
The health issue for people isn't really a huge one here. I don't think it's not a safety issue. Peoples already has a regimen for looking for those kind of leaks. These are mostly pretty small leaks. They're not going to let gas build up anywhere where it could explode. But you're right. The environmental factor is a big one because of global warming. Methane is a very powerful, potent greenhouse gas. And then there's also just the wastage of it.
Yeah, and carbon dioxide is the big greenhouse gas that everyone knows about. But methane is really the second most important of the greenhouse gases. It's not as long-living as CO2 in the atmosphere, but while it's here, it's way more potent than carbon dioxide. It's 84 times more potent over a 20-year period. And for people who study climate change, this is really worrisome because right now we're on the cusp of some really bad consequences if we don't sort of slow down global warming, because they're thinking that there could be these feedback loops that begin to happen if it gets much warmer. And so having this methane in the atmosphere, keeping it out of the atmosphere, is pretty important.
Fred Krupp of the Environmental Defense Fund told us that finding and repairing the leaks is important because methane accounts for 25% of the global warming today.
So reducing emissions from our oil and gas supply chain, whether it's from wellheads or the pipes under your street, turns out to be the fastest way to bring down global warming.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to average it out over 500 years or whatever, it would be less. But now is when we're all living, and the next 20 years are important for all of us. You know, if the glaciers continue to melt and more of the Arctic Ocean is melted and not frozen over, it becomes warmer, and it just starts this feedback loop. There's a ton of methane underneath the permafrost in the Arctic regions. If that permafrost starts melting, you know, some people call it game over for climate. But, I mean, I don't know if that's, like, really an apt description, but there's some real stuff that we want to prevent from happening to prevent sort of runaway climate change.
Bill, let's talk about some of the details they gave specifically about Pittsburgh. So I believe the cars drove about 320 miles, and they detected some 201 leaks. But the vast majority, I believe 85%, were considered minor. And you alluded to that a little earlier, that they're not immediate safety concerns about, you know, some sort of explosion or what, correct?
Correct. This is really an environmental initiative, principally, you know, also one of efficiency. But for Peoples Gas, they acknowledge this, which was interesting, and it was good to hear. They are concerned about this as a purely an environmental issue.
And some of these is sort of a snapshot over time, really. It's not what is there exactly today on this particular day, but these detections were taking place last year during 2015 over a period of some months. But it gives you an idea of what the leaks are like. So there could be additional leaks now, and some of the ones that were leaking could have been repaired.
Well, these were only in a handful of neighborhoods. They basically did downtown, Strip District, Highland Park, Hill District, I think a little bit in Oakland. So this is really just like a small portion of the city, although it should be said these are also areas where you would expect older infrastructure to begin with. So that might be representative of some of the oldest areas in the city in terms of the leakage.
And I saw that they actually have better sensors than Peoples, which is great, but, you know, kind of hope that Peoples would have really good sensors too. But,
right.
You know, I guess it might help them determine where to fix first. You don't want to, if you don't have a leaky pipe, you don't want to tear that up and fix that pipe if the next block over there's a ton of leaks.
Right. The big difference, I think, in the sensing equipment is that Peoples equipment says there is a leak. The stuff they're using on these Google cars is how big is the leak. It also tells you the scope of it.
Let's face it. We like to compare ourselves. We always like to compare with other parts of the country, other cities. I mentioned other cities have had this methane mapping as well. And I noticed from the report that Boston and the borough of Staten Island in New York City had the worst leak rate. And I believe Indianapolis had the best. I mean, is it just a matter of where they happen to drive or what? Or what?
Probably you would guess, I think the supposition is that it's age. I mean, Boston and New York and Pittsburgh, these are really old cities.
And therefore old infrastructure.
Old infrastructure, you know. I mean, you just look at the streets in Pittsburgh. It's just stuff falls apart. Indianapolis, newer. So you'd expect their pipe system to be in better shape.
Bill, what did Morgan O'Brien say from Peoples about, okay, how can they use this because they are under a massive replacement project? I believe it's a 20-year plan and multiple billions of dollars, I believe about $3 billion.
That's what he said, yeah. So they're already doing this. They're already replacing pipes around town. They're going to use this to prioritize, basically. If these sensors find there's a really bad leak in one particular place, they're going to maybe target that area first for replacing the pipes to help cut down on this leakage.
Our guests on The Confluence today, Bill O'Driscoll. You just heard him. He's a reporter with Pittsburgh City Paper and Reed Frazier, reporter for Allegheny Front. Let's move on to something that happened Wednesday, the Shale Conference and Public Health. Now, this is a conference that hosted by the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health. I believe it was sponsored by the League of Women Voters. Reed, what was the purpose? Is this a one-time thing or what?
It happens every year. It's just a way to bring some of the researchers from around the country really together who are looking into the question of whether shale gas development impacts human health in places like Pennsylvania and elsewhere. And over the years, a lot of the folks that are studying this from, you know, Colorado, other states, really come here and give highlights of their research and offer tips and just information for themselves, not just for themselves, of course, but for the general public to get their...
So they don't want it to sit on a shelf somewhere.
That is not what they want. Yes, they want people to know what their research is showing and whether or not that might have any policy implications.
Has the research or the approach to research when it comes to drilling in the shale formation and the potential impact on individuals' health, the environment, has the approach to research changed?
Yeah. You know, in the beginning, there were a lot of anecdotes that people had that they were having nausea or runny nose or headaches. But anecdotes are not great for science. They're good for journalists like me. But over the years, the data sets have gotten better in terms of being more objective, too. Scientists used to have these sort of self-reporting studies where they would go to their house, somebody's house, and say, hey, have you experienced any health impacts from the natural gas well down the road? Now, of course, that's not a great way to conduct a rigorous scientific survey. So really, I would say the sort of biggest paper that was presented at the conference this year is an NIH-funded study from the Johns Hopkins University in which they looked at thousands and thousands of medical records, which are way more objective than knocking on your door and asking you if you've gotten sick. And they are analyzing them for patterns to see if people are getting certain symptoms if they're closer to more and bigger gas wells. And they are finding some interesting correlations between some illnesses and proximity to drilling.
We should probably add here just as background that when drilling happens, many people have thought of impacts on water, you know, that, right. that methane can migrate into water or possibly even other toxic chemicals. But there's also pretty heavy air impacts, too. Toxic airborne chemicals get released from the drilling process, benzene, toluene, stuff like that. And it can, and theoretically or hypothetically, are some of the things that lead to, you know, people having nosebleeds, nausea, skin rashes, all this other stuff, in addition to whatever impact there might be on the water.
In addition, I mean, there's just a lot of trucks, and trucks run on diesel fuel, and they kick up dirt and dust. And, you know, another thing that researchers have been bringing up that isn't quite as sort of alarming, but can have just as big an impact on health is stress, because a lot of people in these communities, if they're not happy about a gas well on your road and dozens of trucks a day lumbering down your road, they get stressed out. And stress is pretty much bad for every kind of health metric that you can think of.
I understand a couple of the primary topics that were discussed had to do with asthma and setbacks. Now, for the last handful of years, we've been hearing about just how many people are suffering from asthma. And so what did we learn about asthma and shale drilling? And I want to talk about setbacks as well.
Well, the Johns Hopkins study that I referenced showed sort of the closer you are to more and bigger gas wells producing more gas, the more likely you were to have asthma or to have like an asthma hospitalization.
That seems to make sense.
Or need a corticosteroid. Well, I mean,
you are to a irritant, if we'll call it that,
yeah,
the chances are that you are going to be affected.
Yeah, but they do need to do the studies,
right,
and do the math and figure out if there is a correlation. And if there is, I mean, another sort of axiom of public health is a correlation does not imply causation. So just because you have more of these cases near gas wells, that doesn't necessarily mean that the gas wells are the cause.
Right.
It could be something else. So they, you know, you have to go through a lot of iterations of the study to like kind of nail it down and say, yes, we can say with 99% certainty that this is the cause of these symptoms.
Right. And Bill, of course, if you already have asthma, that could definitely exacerbate the problem.
Well, clearly, yeah, yeah. And they found, this reminds me just of studies they've done in relation to, say, mountaintop removal mining in places like West Virginia, where there have also been studies that have found a really high correlation between folks who live close to those kind of fossil fuel extraction sites and bad health outcomes.
And another thing to keep in mind is we don't have any idea about long-term health impacts, nor could we. I mean, this health boom, this shale boom has been here for 10 years. Some of these cancer or type diseases take decades to develop. And even when they do, even if there were some sort of cancer cluster, it would be very difficult to prove a causation from one to another. So there's a lot that researchers are really interested in finding out. And, you know, some of these databases that they're tapping into could really push some of the science further.
I want to quickly get to setbacks. Any new information about that, about, quote, safe distances? Do we have any new information about setbacks? And what exactly is a setback?
Right. So a setback is, say you have a gas well or say you have a house and somebody wants to drill in the field next to you. The setback is the minimum distance between the gas well and your front door or your wall.
Right.
So there was a study that was presented at the Shale Health Conference this week in which the authors tried to get a bunch of experts together to determine, okay, what is a safe setback? They pretty much all agreed that a quarter mile is not far enough to protect public health from things like explosions, but also from air pollution. But then they tried to determine, okay, all right, a quarter mile is too close. What is a safe distance? And there really was no consensus about what was a safe distance, which was maybe not as satisfying. Around a mile to a mile and a quarter was sort of the closest they could come to. Okay, the most people agree that this is very safe. But if you were to game that out in Pennsylvania, that would really limit where a lot of the drilling could take place, because pretty much everywhere in Pennsylvania, there's somebody's house. So it would be very interesting to see the state try to enact a setback of a mile or so.
Especially if they can't quite agree on the distance, how do you push forth on some sort of new public policy?
Yeah, you know, and we've seen even in the latest oil and gas rules that the DEP has been working on for years and years and years, you know, half of those rules got thrown out at the last minute because of pushback from the legislature, and the rules that did get approved are now part of a lawsuit brought by the gas industry.
All right, Bill, we have just 2 minutes left, and I want to briefly get to another finding that was released this week by Allegheny County, the Allegheny County Health Department, having to do with diesel emissions in downtown Pittsburgh. What did we learn? Did we learn anything new from this?
It seems to sort of ratify common sense, I suppose, and in that what they found was that most of the emissions come from buses, and most of them seem to cluster in particular areas rather than being spread out evenly. It was downtown that they were studying, which is, of course, where so many of the buses from around the city converge.
Red lights are there to stop you.
Right. Lots of stoppage. Also, lots of other vehicles that are going to cause diesel problems. But, you know, mostly buses they found.
So was this to maybe set the stage to, okay, here are numbers to confirm what we thought, and now we can push farther for cleaner diesel, for retrofitting of vehicles, or what?
Well, they did note in the study that many of the Port Authority's buses are set to be upgraded. They're upgrading their fleet, basically. So that's happening on a sort of continual basis. So if we did the same study, you know, 5 years from now, we might expect different results from that. Yeah, but this could be a way to sort of say, hey, maybe there's ways we can prevent these traffic backups a little bit so these buses aren't idling so long at stoplights, for instance.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. Great to have you with us. Bill O'Driscoll is a reporter for the Pittsburgh City Paper. Reed Frazier is a reporter for the Allegheny Front. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
3,000 municipal leaders converged on Pittsburgh this week to discuss everything from transportation to public safety challenges. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. 3,000 of the nation's mayors, city council members, and other municipal officials are in Pittsburgh this week for the National League of Cities annual summit, talking about everything from transportation and infrastructure to public safety. Joining us to discuss what these city leaders are discussing, Adam Smeltz is City Hall reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Adam, welcome so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Ryan Dito is a reporter with Pittsburgh City Paper. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks.
If you have a question or a comment, feel free to tweet us at WESA Confluence. Okay, according to the League of Cities, these leaders, quote, will explore and find solutions to the most pressing challenges currently facing cities, end quote. So, gentlemen, what are these most pressing challenges they're talking about, right?
You know, something they've been talking about a lot is transit, definitely, kind of trying to get more infrastructure into these cities to kind of help, you know, rehab them. They've also spoken about affordable housing, and also manufacturing has been a big thing, too.
They've also been talking quite a bit about race relations. At an opening session yesterday, the executive director of the NLC, Clarence Anthony, made a big point of encouraging communities and leaders of communities across the country to acknowledge tensions in their midst and to bring neighborhoods and neighborhood leaders to the table and to have community conversations around race.
So tangible things like infrastructure, things you can see, put your hands on. And then other aspirations, as you say, the race relations, Adam.
Absolutely. There are kind of big picture conversations going on over there, as well as the nitty-gritty of how to get grant money to fill the potholes.
How much of this, these aspects, whether it is economic development, whether it's technology use, sustainability, transportation, I want to get into some of these a little more in depth, but how many of there, in a sense, can these municipal leaders control and do themselves, and how much... how many of them are sort of, they need help, whether it's from the feds, whether it's from their own state governments or whatever?
Yeah, well, there are only so many cities that have like homeroom charters that, you know, they can actually control their own destiny to an extent, right? Like, you know, Pittsburgh is one of those cities, you know, bigger cities are also have that power, but it's still predicated on a lot of funding and a lot of support from state and federal governments. And I think a lot of these leaders are a little anxious about kind of what's going to happen moving forward in terms of a new GOP administration federally. And then also a lot of state governments are also, controlled, you know, by the GOP that has kind of had a less government role. So I think they're a little anxious of how exactly they're going to get things done.
And at its core, the National League of Cities is a lobbying advocacy organization for some 19,000 communities across the country. So for a lot of these mayors and council members coming into Pittsburgh this week, this organization is their lobbying group. This is the organization that they turn to represent them in Washington to try to bring some of that money in. So they are having a lot of conversations this week about how to approach the new administration, how to approach the new Congress, and how they want to set their priorities going forward.
Yeah, one of the things that they're, you know, doing is kind of coming together and mayor to mayor or, you know, councilman to councilman to, you know, talk about, policy agenda that they right. would, you know, present to the president or, you know, or to the state government to kind of be like, here's what we need.
Okay, so two-part question. I mentioned 3,000 municipal leaders. I mean, what are the range of the municipalities, the size of the municipalities, and can they come together just because of the size differential on what the common needs are and a common policy they would like to see from the feds? Adam?
The scope of the municipalities represented here, I mean, is phenomenal. It really runs the range from the biggest cities to the smallest cities in the country. I think the outgoing leader of the board of the NLC is a former mayor of a relatively small city in Missouri.
Yeah, Joplin, Missouri.
Yeah, I wanted to say that, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah,
so I'm glad you have that
which
detail.
Is very rural. It's like totally in the corner of like almost like the Ozarks in terms of near Arkansas. It's not like a huge city.
No.
By any means.
But did you, as you were talking to guys, were talking to these leaders, did you get a sense that there was sort of, okay, we disagree on this, we have these needs, we have these other needs, but here we can come together on these so that we can put forth a policy that we would like to see from the federal government.
So they didn't actually really have any, like, I guess, disagreements. There wasn't a lot of, I guess, politics involved. It was really much...
Oh, that politicians, elected officials, not much politics?
Well, I mean, not the ones I talked to. They weren't, you know, they weren't talking about ideals. They were talking about getting things for their cities that they need. They were talking about infrastructure spending. They were talking about just getting potholes, you know, filled in and stuff like that. So I think that's why they wanted to come together, was to really just try to get stuff done in their cities and maybe avoid some of the, you know, rhetoric that had, you know, been talked about all year long.
And you also see some cities of different types or different categories forming their own little small groups and talking about issues that are specific to them. I talked with the borough manager of State College Borough up in Center County,
right.
And they have, of course, that's a college town, it's home to Penn State University, and they have their own set of issues around binge drinking, how to generate enough tax revenue from a resident base that is at least half student and not making a whole lot of money. So how do you bring in a lot of income tax, a lot of local income tax, when that's the nature of your tax base?
And yet you still have to provide those services that any city and any municipality would.
Absolutely. So you see, for example, college towns forming their own groups at meetings like this, at conventions like this, trying to work through issues that are specific to their own communities.
Yeah, I spoke to a small town mayor up in this Shoreline, Washington, which is a suburb of Seattle, and the thing he was most worried about was just making sure the transportation funding wasn't cut off, because they're set to get a light rail extension from Seattle up to their town that would, you know, really, I guess, connect their town into the metropolis that is Seattle. And that's something that he just really hoped that, I guess, you know, the NLC could really come together and really push towards, I guess, a federal agenda.
One of our reporters was talking with Matthew Colvin of the National League of Cities, and he was talking about being good partners with Washington, especially when it comes to new technologies, for example, self-driving cars. And today there was a presentation about the self-driving Uber cars. But quote, according to Colvin, quote, stay out of our way and let us lead on these issues, end quote. So here they're presenting ideas for what we need from Washington, but part of those needs might be don't hinder us from doing what we'd like to do as well.
Yeah, and actually, I'm working on an article right now that's kind of about that. There's been a lot of attack from state governments that have kind of inhibited cities, like in North Carolina when they passed HB2, which basically right. said you can't pass a bill to protect LGBT residents. And here, you know, in Pennsylvania, it's been very similar, with a lot of state legislators passing laws that would prohibit sanctuary cities and these other kind of things. So I think that is kind of like a very big thing for cities is, hey, we're kind of getting stuff done. Just let us handle it and, you know, provide us support when we need it, I guess. And it's been anxiety producing for a lot of them.
I mentioned Matthew Colvin before, and you guys have been talking a bit about transportation, whether it's extension of rail service or other infrastructure needs. Colvin said that he's noticed among the participants at this summit concern about President-elect Trump's infrastructure proposal, that it would put construction and management of projects in the hands of the private sector.
They're going to want to recoup their money, though, because they're spending money to manage it. So they may start tolling all of your bridges. So now every bridge becomes a toll bridge in Pittsburgh as a way of generating revenue to pay back the private investors.
Did you hear similar comments like that, gentlemen?
I didn't hear any kind of like bigger issue that kind of like, will things become public-private partnership? That actually seems like something most places are pitching, you know, that like a lot of towns in America have already had public-private partnerships with, you know, transit companies, with tech companies. So I think that is like a bigger, you know, issue, big question, but I think a lot of towns are just kind of like, well, we need to do this to support our residents.
And a lot of towns, a lot of their leaders have sort of at this point a sense of hesitation about what the Trump administration will mean for them. They're waiting to see what the more specific policy proposals will be coming out of the Trump administration regarding relationships with cities and how the federal government will interface with cities and local municipalities. That a lot of leaders at the local level are kind of looking at Trump at this point as something of an empty vessel. They're not sure what's going to emerge in the next several months.
Yeah, that's something I've seen too. A lot of people I've been talking to, mayors from small towns in Wisconsin, mayors from small towns in North Carolina, that they're like kind of hopeful actually, because he is a big city guy. You know, he did say that he does support a lot of transit and infrastructure and a lot of big city things, but there's also still a lot of anxiety whether or not he's going to follow through on that or if Congress is going to support that. So it's really anxious for them.
Well, let's follow up on that. So is the concern or the question mark, the uncertainty, if you would, more so about Trump administration or about the Republican-controlled Congress?
The people I talked to, it was definitely the Republican Congress much more than Trump. Because Trump did, like I just said, like did have these ideals, and he is a wild card, but they really have not a lot of faith in the Republican Congress, even though a lot of them are from Republican cities. I mean, like, I was speaking to, the incoming president of the NLC, and he said that, over half their members are Republican, mayors or, council people. So I think they just want to see that support.
At the same time, there's a lot of rhetorical focus, I would say, on the arrival of the Trump administration. Yesterday, when Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto offered his welcoming remarks here downtown, he pointed out a local campaign by the Sprout Fund, which is based out of Garfield. It's called 100 Days of Us,
right.
And it's timed to coincide with the first 100 days of the Trump administration. And the idea is to encourage local folks who have ideas to sort of promote civic engagement to apply for grant money through the Sprout Fund to make those ideas turn into small projects. And Sprout has set aside, I think, around $100,000 to
right.
make that happen. And
yeah, the engagement, I think the message is the engagement is it's not just once a year or whatever on election day. The engagement is year-round or the opportunities should be year-round for citizens.
That's certainly what Mayor Peduto was encouraging yesterday, and he was pushing all cities to get on board with this idea of 100 Days of Us. There's a Twitter campaign, there's a website that the Twitter hashtag is hashtag 100 Days, I believe.
Yeah, with this really surprising election result where cities were really outvoted by suburbs and rural areas, I think it's actually galvanized a lot of people who live in cities that want to see more action, but they're going to have to take more action. I think that's what the mayor was kind of saying, is like, hey, do this, focus on, I guess school elections. That's kind of also what the NLC president was saying, is, you got to stay focused all the time, not just, come these big giant elections or anything like that.
Adam, there's something I want to touch upon further that you brought up earlier, and that had to do with what local officials, local leaders can sort of do or encourage on their own. They don't need help, support. Well, support's always welcome from the federal government. And that has to do with race relations within your own municipality.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said earlier, the executive director of the National League of Cities made it a top priority. He made it the focus of his opening remarks yesterday to encourage leaders from across the country to go out into their communities to sit down and have very frank conversations on race relations. Here in Pittsburgh, certainly, we've seen a heavy focus from the police force under the recently departed police chief McClay on race relations. And I think certainly everyone expects that focus to continue here under the new chief, Chief Schubert, Chief Schubert.
I think there's a little bit more anxiety over that, though, because of Trump running on basically a law and order kind of, presidency. And I mean, McClay did leave because he couldn't, maybe he felt like he was at his peak. So maybe that continues, but there's also seems to be a pushback that maybe some people in power don't want that to happen as much. So it's very disconcerting for people who believe in police community relations.
But the leaders can do that at the local level.
But unless they're stopped by the state, right? Because a lot of state legislators are doing that now. They're basically saying, no, you can't do that. We're ahead of you. You can't do that. So I think it's going to be really interesting the next couple of years in terms of, what happens there.
Okay. Just 30 seconds left, gentlemen. Is this a lot of talk, a lot of planning, a lot of policy making or whatever. Anything concrete coming out of this summit? All right, Adam. You look at Ryan. I'm looking at
you. Like, you know, time will tell. I think a lot of these conversations could very well lead to concrete lobbying goals and agenda setting.
I think it's going to come down to how well city leaders react with their residents and actually get them to attend meetings, talk about policy, vote for things, all these things. That's really going to, you know, I guess what's going to come down. And signs are pointing to that, but I'm still a little skeptical.
Okay. Ryan Dito is a reporter with Pittsburgh City Paper. Adam Smeltz is City Hall reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
After more than 7 years on the job, David Hickton is stepping down as U.S. Attorney for Western Pennsylvania. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. 2 weeks ago, Pittsburgh's top cop, Cameron McClay, announced he was leaving as the city's police chief. Monday, the top federal law enforcement officer for Western Pennsylvania announced his resignation. David Hickton will step down November 28th. Until the Trump administration appoints a new U.S. attorney, Hickton's top assistant, Sue Song, will take over as acting U.S. attorney. Let's talk about these developments regarding the U.S. Attorney's Office with Rich Lord, reporter with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Rich. Good to have you here.
Hey, Kevin. Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Zach Needles, reporter for the Legal Intelligencer. Welcome, Zach.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Now, if you have a question or a comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. Gentlemen, it's common practice. We know that when a new administration, at whether it's a city, state, federal level, comes in, for department heads to submit their resignations, then the incoming elected officials decide whether to accept it or not. So was David Hickton just getting a jump on things because it was highly likely that President-elect Trump's Justice Department would replace him or not? Let's start with you, Rich.
I think Mr. Hickton was attempting to give his longtime deputy, Sue Song, a chance to get her feet wet, to get comfortable with the office for a while before anyone would come in and appoint a replacement for Mr. Hickton. He, as you may recall, took office in 2010.
Right.
His predecessor, Mary Beth Buchanan, decided to stay in that office fairly deep into the Obama administration until finally the politics sorted itself out and Mr. Hickton took over that post. So he's apparently decided not to take that same tack and to get out and let his longtime deputy really get a strong start.
Zach?
I think that's exactly right. And Sue Song could be in that role for, close to a year. I would imagine it's going to take some time for an actual appointment to be made. I'm sure President-elect Trump is going to be focused more on the high-level cabinet positions before he starts to look at the various U.S. attorneys. So I think Rich is right. It's going to David was just trying to give Sue a jump on things and have her get comfortable because it's probably going to be a role she's going to inhabit for some time.
Of course, you brought up, Rich, Mary Beth Buchanan. She was appointee of President George W. Bush at the beginning of early on in his administration. So, gentlemen, a little background. Who is David Hickton?
David Hickton was a white-collar defense lawyer for a long time. Mr. Hickton was involved with a lot of cases in which companies needed to defend themselves against anything from a hearing loss case to, particularly instances in which companies had very large exposures. He was their defense lawyer. He became politically involved. He was a longtime friend of Senator Bob Casey. And that raises an interesting issue going forward. A lot of what happens from here on in that office is going to depend on the two U.S. senators and who they support, and particularly, of course, Senator Pat Toomey. So there will be a sorting out process involving the new administration, the Republican senator, to some extent the Democratic senator, before we know who the replacement is.
Anything else we should know, Zach, about David Hickton?
Well, as we saw during his tenure in office, I mean, his two sort of areas of focus and really passion as U.S. attorney were cybercrime and the opioid and heroin epidemics. And those are both priority areas for the DOJ under Attorney General Lynch. But, you know, the U.S. attorneys themselves have pretty broad latitude, I think, to pick their areas of focus. So during his time in office, Mr. Hickton focused on those two areas in part because of the resources available to him in Pittsburgh with regard to cybercrime. I mean, there's an FBI cyber group based there. There's the National Cyber Forensics and Training Alliance. There's the Cybersecurity Research Group at Carnegie Mellon University. So there's plenty of tools at his disposal as far as cybercrime goes. And then as far as the heroin and opioid epidemic, unfortunately, that's a major problem in a lot of areas of the country, but particularly in Western Pennsylvania, and he identified that. So that's some insight into why he chose those two areas to focus on.
An interesting thing, too, about Mr. Hickton was his approach. The core job of a U.S. attorney is to prosecute really bad guys. And he did that, but he also liked to bring people together. He had a 75-member working group, for instance, on the whole opioid thing. He had civil rights working groups. If there was one, I guess, concern about that style, it was perhaps this. If you're bringing all these people together to try to solve a problem, what if you find out that one of those institutions is part of the problem? Can you then prosecute at the same time you're at the table with someone? It'll be interesting to see whether the successor decides to have that same kind of conciliatory emphasis or really focuses in on the prosecutorial and investigative role of the office.
It's The Confluence. We're talking with Rich Lord, reporter for Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Zach Needles, managing editor of the Legal Intelligencer, about the departure as U.S. attorney of David Hickton. I want to go back to one more thing about David Hickton. It's the sort of tradition of law enforcement in his family. His father was under consideration to be U.S. attorney, I believe, in the Carter administration. In June, David appeared on WESA's podcast, Criminal Injustice, and he said that being U.S. attorney was his dream job.
I always knew from a personal standpoint that I wanted to do public service as a big part of my career. And I had identified this particular job long ago as the job that if I could get it, I would not let any moss grow under my feet.
Rich, do you think that David Hickton really liked this job? This was the job he really wanted and liked?
From all of my interactions with him, he enjoyed this immensely. He really liked that power, particularly to bring people together around a solution. And his family experience very much affected his prosecutorial approach. He was a very cautious prosecutor. He wasn't going to jump the gun and indict somebody because he thought it would make a good headline. He particularly, as we saw when he was investigating the city, when he investigated and in fact prosecuted our police chief in the city of Pittsburgh, he approached that methodically. He then went deep into an investigation, which became very public, of our mayor at the time, Luke Ravenstahl, but then stepped back from the edge and did not prosecute, said he presumably did not find criminal activity. But it was very clear that he was going to approach that in a cautious manner, not in a headline-grabbing manner. And I think that was colored by his father's past.
Right. Zach Needles, I want to continue the discussion that you brought up dealing with cybercrime. And you mentioned that Hickton talked about the resources here in the Pittsburgh area for him. But also, he really gained some national and maybe even international attention in some of the cyber security cases that he pursued.
Absolutely. Yeah, he was actually the subject of a lead story in Rolling Stone magazine for his work on the Dark Code case, where he helped to bring down 70 members of an international cybercrime group. And some of his other cases made headlines too, and I would agree with Rich. I mean, David Hickton is not a flashy guy. He was not a headline grabber, but he did speak at an event we held earlier this year where he talked about the concept of moonshots, and cybercrime was one of the the moonshots that he decided to take as a U.S. attorney. And what he meant by that was, you know, going after big game, going after difficult, complex issues, not shying away from what you think is something important that you need to tackle, and using your education and your resources to deal with those issues. So he said cybercrime and the opioid epidemic were two moonshots for him.
He was, in fact, the big international story when he prosecuted five members of the Chinese People's Liberation Army who were accused of hacking into American institutions. For that day, he was the center of the news.
Was that surprising? I mean, sort of surprising to me. Here, a U.S. attorney based in Pittsburgh, Western Pennsylvania, of course, and he's filed the charges, and he's going after elements in the Chinese military, or he's going after a Russian conspiracy and hacking. And why isn't this coming out of, you know, the Justice Department in Washington? Why is it coming out of Western Pennsylvania?
Clearly, Washington was apprised of every step that he was taking, particularly when it came to indicting members of the Chinese People's Liberation Army. But the argument was the expertise was here. You have a guy working in the FBI here who is one of the most celebrated white hat hackers around. In fact, you have several people in a cell here who some of whom came out of CMU, but some of whom came out of much more modest sort of educational backgrounds and yet became among the international leading experts in this. And because I think, in part because of Hickton's personality, they were able to forge international ties to the Netherlands, to Britain, to Israel, that really paid off in some of those big international cybercrime prosecutions.
I want to touch, we just have a couple minutes left, and I do want to go a little bit more on the opioid crisis. How important was this? I mean, because it touches so many people. We all seem to know somebody who's been touched by the opioid crisis. How important was this to him, Zach?
Extremely important. He said to one of his close friends and colleagues that after a decade or so of this becoming a really major problem in Western Pennsylvania, he just felt like he couldn't sit still. I mean, we heard in that quote that he said he wouldn't let any moss grow under his feet as U.S. attorney, and he certainly didn't on this issue. I think it was something it was very personally important to him. As I said, it is a priority area of the of Maine justice, but for David Hickton, I think this was an extremely important and personal issue for him that he wanted to tackle because he saw it, you know, all around him in his hometown.
All right, we have just 1 minute, guys. I do want to mention that the incoming Trump administration, it'll be up to them to, of course, appoint the new U.S. attorney. Are we getting any sense yet in what type of focus that person might have, whereas David Hickton focused on cybercrime and then the opioid crisis? Any sense? Just a quick time, Rich.
I'm sure not going to try to read the tea leaves of that at this point. I think we're more likely than we have been in the past to see an attorney from outside of Allegheny County leading that post, since that's where a lot of the Republican support comes from. We'll certainly see the transition team has talked a lot about fentanyl, the deadly drug that comes in from China, and also heroin coming in from Mexico. So I don't think we'll see a change in the focus on the opioids.
Zach, 15 seconds.
I would agree with that, and I do think that Attorney General Sessions will set the tempo in some way for the whole country, and sort of set the priorities and readjust some of the priorities. But I agree with Rich. I don't want to go too far out on a limb in my predictions for the U.S. attorney in Pennsylvania.
All righty, Zach. Zach Needles is the managing editor for the Legal Intelligencer. Rich Lord is reporter for the Pittsburgh Post. He said thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
And finally, the protests against the election of Donald Trump continue. Police have charged two anti-Trump protesters with aggravated assault for allegedly scuffling with officers who tried to keep about 100 marchers out of a University of Pittsburgh dormitory. And police say a 23-year-old student pushed a female officer's patrol bike, and a 20-year-old non-student was arrested after allegedly grabbing an officer's protective vest and wouldn't let go. And that's the Confluence for this week. Our engineer is Tom Hurley, production assistants from Vince Balestrino. The producer is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.